Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Oh, never a dull moment, is there? It was a beautiful weekend, at least it was here in North Carolina. I hope it was a nice weekend wherever you're at. Beautiful weather, got out and about a lot, and was able to enjoy that. Tried to stay away from COVID-19 stories, everything else. Of course, that continues to develop, so I've got a bunch of different things I want to talk about today. We're live on Facebook, by the way, so if you want to go to the Facebook page, The Steve Noble Show, you can go there. Or if you happen to be a personal friend on Facebook, it's also, we jump it over to my personal page via a watch party, so you can join there and comment, and I'm kind of watching that during the show so that we can kind of have an conversation within a conversation, a show within a show, whatever you want to call it. And then one thing I wanted to let you know, and I'll be talking about this tomorrow, I'm playing a little clip for you. We're about to go live with the new podcast, and I'll explain the title because some of you are going to be really upset with me because of the title of the podcast, which is, Who is this SOB? And people go, well, what does that stand for? It stands for what you think it stands for. But I'll explain all that and why would a Christian be using that kind of language, all these types of concerns, and really the target. But we're going live on all bunch of different podcast platforms this afternoon, working through the last few kinks. So before I go to bed tonight, we should be live all over the place. This week, just the introductory episode, and then next week, the first four episodes will drop. And I'll explain all that, play a little clip for you tomorrow so you can kind of hear what's going on. But today we'll stay on target with all the things going on in the news and so much to look at and discuss and some valuable lessons here. So we talked to Bishop Wooden on Friday. We talked about the Ahmaud Arbery story down in Georgia, which happened in February, and then nothing much happened until the video popped last week of the actual shooting there and the confrontation in the street in that neighborhood. And now more information coming out, more videos coming out of Ahmaud that he went in, spent about 3 minutes inside of a house that was under construction in that neighborhood, and then different reports about somebody yelling at him, and then he went back. Was he running? Was he walking through the neighborhood? What about his previous experience with law enforcement and all these things? And it was a very valuable lesson and an ongoing lesson about how we handle developing news stories. And the same thing we've been doing this game, and I've been playing this game myself for years, and we really struggle with this now as a culture. And for me on the radio and Facebook and kind of reacting to news as it breaks, and we're all kind of in this mode where we tend to come to a pretty quick conclusion. We have our confirmation biases going. And if you're if you believe that racism is a problem in America and there's too many shootings of young unarmed black men, as soon as you see something, you'll tend to take a certain position. People that think that's a bunch of gobbledygook or it's an overreaction, or you think that you're just prejudiced against white people, blah, 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 tend to take an act, tend to take the opposite position. And we do it almost immediately. And then you have more news comes out and more stories and more angles. And like we talked with Bishop Wooden on Friday, that, hey, we all should be interested in the legal system, hopefully working and doing its job, that people are presumed innocent until proven guilty and not vice versa. And we did the same thing. I remember early on in February talking about COVID-19 when people were like, oh, it's just the same thing as the flu. And I got, I found some information and I'm like, no, it isn't the same thing as the flu. And look at the mortality rates amongst older people. And there's 31 million people in America that are 70 and older. And what if it hits them and the mortality rates there? We've got this millions of people dying and really kind of defecated, got on my high horse there. And then the story has changed over time. And then in the second segment today, I'll do a bunch of COVID-19 updates with Georgia and something that was reported that Deborah Birx said last week in a closed task force meeting, the coronavirus task force up there in D.C., where she's basically saying, I can't trust anything from the CDC. And we everybody's got a horse in the race, right? And we just jump to conclusions quickly. So in the Ahmaud Arbery case, whereas we were in one thing last week and seeing this video, which is horrifying, and people kind of taking matters into their own hands and the citizens arrest. And, fine, you want to go confront somebody and talk to them. You want to call the police. You want to try to hold them there, even forcibly, okay. But to go with a shotgun and a 357 Magnum and to kind of pull your truck up in the street and all that kind of stuff all seems like an overreaction to me. And we'll see what happens. But then there's a friend on Facebook sends me another video. This is from a gentleman who's a former police officer, a guy named Brandon Tatum. He's got a website. He's got a YouTube channel, a motivational speaker. He's a Christian, uber conservative, African-American. Okay, a former cop. So he gets on there and shows some additional footage of Ahmaud Arbery when he went into the house that was under construction, and then it looked like somebody yelled something at him, and then he ran down the street, and I thought he was out for a jog and all this stuff. No, we do not have all the information yet, but sometimes we act like we do, and emotionally we react, and which I completely understand, especially the emotional reaction in many ways, most ways perhaps warranted by my good friend Bishop Wooden. And I had an emotional reaction, and I'm white, and but it's just, we just don't leave much room anymore because the media feeds this way, we feed this way, and we just come up to with our conclusions and presumptions of innocent or guilt immediately. And so this guy, Brandon Tatum, did this video coming at it as a former police officer going, well, you see his here, you see here, and you, we don't know this, we don't know that, and here's this situation, casting some doubt on the way that a lot of us were reacting last week based on what we saw. And so this other video came out, and then you've got they had a gathering down in Georgia just over the weekend. New video from the day of the incident, apparently taken from a home security camera, shows the jogger entering a garage. That would be Ahmaud. At a home construction site, after several minutes, the jogger returns to running, and then another neighbor is seen around the same time a 9/11 call was made. So there's the new video that was obtained by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution at a rally on Saturday night. Several family members responded to the video. If he committed a crime, why don't you just call the authorities, Marcus Arbery told WSB-TV2. But you came at him like you were hunting an animal, and an attorney representing the family also issued a statement. Our officers reviewed the surveillance video, which appears to show a person believed to be Ahmaud Arbery entering a property under construction. The individual remains on property for under 3 minutes before continuing to jog down the road. This video is consistent with the evidence already known to us. And then he goes on and presents his case. My point being, whether it's this, the COVID-19 situation is continuing to unravel. And I don't mean that. I just mean to unfold, okay? Some of it's unraveling because there's COVID-19 and there's COVID-19 agenda. There's science, there's scientism, there's philosophy, there's politics, all these things involved. And we just need to, are we willing to wait? I don't know that we're willing to wait for much of anything anymore. I'm just cautioning mostly myself as well as you. Let's slow down at least a little and try to actually pursue the truth as opposed to just being led about by our emotions. And we'll see, hopefully, what the truth is. We'll be right back. I dare you. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. Good to be with you. And just talking a little bit about some more information coming out about the Ahmaud Arbery case down in Georgia, which is developing, and some other video coming out, and just cautioning all of us, especially myself, just slow down, slow to speak, slow to anger, quick to listen. And we want the truth. We want justice. I want the facts. But I don't know about you, but I struggle with holding myself back. I can jump on a bandwagon sometimes, and part of the fruit of the spirit is self-control, and we all need to work on that. Same thing's true with the COVID-19 thing. So I've got several things there that I want to share, and Bill Gates, who's becoming increasingly more alarming in the way he's looking at all this, a short clip from an interview he did just on April 9th, okay, so this was a month ago, speaking to the Financial Times, but he's repeated this mantra in many other places, talking about vaccines and shutting down the world's economy, which is easy when you're like the second or third wealthiest guy on the planet, right? Okay, thanks for that, Bill. When's the last time you actually had to worry about money? I mean, at any level. So I want to get to that. But one thing, you might have seen this. I just saw this the other day. I knew Ravi Zacharias, who's just one of the greatest apologists in the history, in modern history of the church. Has not been doing well. He had really bad heart or really bad back and back surgery not that long ago. But then he fighting cancer too. And now it looks like Ravi is in his last days here. And I shared an update from his family and the ministry the other day. So I mean, he's had a huge impact on me. I'm sure he's had a huge impact on most of you. I mean, much of my ability to reason and think through things is as a result of listening to hours and hours and hours of Ravi's show and his podcast, and just an incredible combination. And I think the Apostle Paul might have been a lot like this, where you're just unbelievably intelligent and able to slice and dice just about anybody's argument, but he never did. He was never rude. He was never ugly. He was never harsh. Just this loving, kind, compassionate man. I really think like the ultimate example for most of us believers, when you're engaging anybody that disagrees, especially theologically, against a biblical worldview, and he would take people's arguments apart on college campuses. But he always did it with this grace and this compassion and this love, just amazing. So be in prayer for Ravi's wife and his daughters, his family, this ministry. Pretty soon he'll be with the Lord, and he's out of here, man. And praise the Lord for that. Ravi will probably have one of those places in heaven. We'll drive by and go, man, look at this. Who lives there? Ravi Zacharias. Oh, that figures. He'll be one of the well-known people that I think, because he's just done it so well. Anyway, be in prayer for them. I didn't know if you were aware of that. But we just praise the Lord for all Ravi Zacharias he's done in service to the King and the impact he's had really on the whole world, around the whole world, and many of us as individuals. So the COVID-19 thing, my wife corrected me, and I appreciate that. Thank God for our wives, gentlemen, if you're married and God's given you a good wife. I certainly have one I've never earned and couldn't deserve and don't deserve. But yeah, I've been a little flippant about the COVID-19 stuff and a little flippant, about the mask question. And even though I have deep disagreements with people about that, you know, I've been a little flippant as of late. And then we found out through a friend that we knew that used to be at a church here in the Raleigh area. She's up in Virginia now, a young family. And these two young boys are both now in the ICU fighting for their lives. One of them, totally healthy, got COVID-19. The other one got, believe this, H1N1 a while ago, and that was a big issue, and that permanently did harm to his lungs. But they both got it, and they're both young, I think like 18-ish, late teens, something like that. And getting that information in where COVID-19 can seriously affect younger people, mostly older people. We talked on Friday about the increasingly nightmarish situation going on in retirement centers and in rest areas, rest homes around the country. But it does affect young people too, and it affects some people where they don't have any autoimmune problems. There's no pre-existing conditions. They're perfectly healthy. And then it sometimes happens with the flu too. But I'm thankful to my wife that she was rightfully so upset with me that I was just being a little too flippant about it, and lives are being destroyed. And I can turn around and go, well, I could argue about the whole country who doesn't seem to care much about the 850,000 babies we kill a year, but we go nutso about what's going on with COVID. But those are still lives. If I'm going to be perfectly consistent, I have to be pro-life consistent from the tomb to the womb. From the oldest to the youngest, and all points in between. And every life matters, and every life has an estimable worth. So let's be careful, even when they're arguing about face masks and stuff, let's remember, even though it's not to the level of abortion, every life matters. They all have an estimable worth, and they were all created in God's image. So we need to, thank you, honey, for challenging me on that. I needed to deal with that one. Okay, so this is really interesting. Georgia, who got excoriated by Trump, right? Georgia got excoriated because they opened up. That was April 24th, and they just came out over the weekend. Today marks the lowest number of COVID-19 positive patients currently hospitalized statewide. This is Kemp, the governor of Georgia. Since hospitals began reporting this data on April 8th, today also marks the lowest total of ventilators in use, 897 with 1,945 available. We will win this fight together. He got excoriated and hammered. And the big deal in Georgia is the incubation period, the CDC's thought to extend to 14 days with a medium time 4 to 5 days. So when they started to reopen things April 24th, that was going to be a total nightmare. You would think to see, based on the numbers that we do have, that by the beginning of May, man, they'd be spiking back up there, but they're actually going down, and today have their lowest numbers. So more information there. Deborah Birx the other day in a meeting this week. Dr. Deborah Birx, okay? This was, look at this headline. Deborah Birx reportedly tells Task Force she can trust nothing from the CDC. Whoa, what? During a Task Force meeting last Wednesday, this was reported in the Washington Post on the 9th. A heated discussion broke out between Deborah Birx, the physician who oversees the administration's coronavirus response, and Robert Redfield, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Birx and others were frustrated with the CDC's antiquated system for tracking virus data, which they worried was inflating some statistics, such as mortality rate and case count, by as much as 25%. Quote, "There's nothing from the CDC that I can trust," Birx reportedly said, according to two of the people. The flare-up came 2 days after it was reported that an internal government model based on data from the CDC and other agencies projected the death count would rise to 3,000 a day by June 1st. So even inside that organism, the Coronavirus Task Force, they're all over the map. And then you get somebody like Bill Gates talking about.
And what about that trade-off? You just mentioned, obviously, the economic pain. What do you think the right balance is between the trade-off of protecting people's lives and the economic hit? I mean, do you see a situation where the global economy could be virtually at a standstill for a year or even more?
Well, it won't go to zero, but it will shrink. Global GDP is going to take, probably the biggest hit ever. You know, maybe the Depression was worse or 1873. I don't know. But in my lifetime, this will be the greatest economic hit. But you don't have a choice. People act like you have a choice. People don't feel like going to the stadium when they might.
So he's going to get to this. I'll play this for you when we come back from the break. And then we'll talk to Congressman Mike Johnson, because Mike is on the Opening Up America Again congressional group of Donald Trump. He was speaking to him, by the way, on Friday, which is why we could. He's like, oh, why didn't Mike call in yet? Oh, he's talking to the president. Okay, fine. So we'll talk to Congressman Mike Johnson from Louisiana, but I want you to hear from the rest of Bill Gates' thing after this. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. I'm just going to finish this clip real quick from Bill Gates. This was an interview he did about a month ago when Bill Gates, who's worth $107 billion, is talking about the massive hit on the economy, not just here in America, but around the world. Then he's talking about, we really don't have a choice. We had to do that. And then he takes his, we really don't have a choice, to a whole nother level. So I just want to, because I started this clip, I want to finish it so you can hear about it. Then we're going to talk to my good friend, Congressman Mike Johnson from Louisiana, who's very involved in all these things with the Republican Study Committee, which came out with a great program in terms of a framework for recovery, accountability, and prosperity. He's also on President Trump's task force for opening up America again. He's part of that group, and he was just with the president on Friday. So we're going to talk to Mike. So just hold on just a second, Mike. I'm going to finish this clip to Bill Gates and listen to what he says here at the end of it. Okay, it's just a little bit less than a minute left to go. Check this out.
Get infected. You know, it's not the government who's saying, okay, just ignore this disease and, you know, people are deeply affected by seeing these deaths, by knowing they could be part of the transmission chain, and you know, old people, their parents, their grandparents could be affected by this. And so you don't get to say ignore what's going on here. There will be the ability, particularly in rich countries, to open up if things are done well over the next few months, but for the world at large, normalcy only returns when we've largely vaccinated the entire global population.
And okay, and so there's some concerns there in and of itself, but we want to jump over here and talk to my good friend, Congressman Mike Johnson from Louisiana. Mike, thanks for calling in, buddy. How are you?
Hey, Steve. Good to talk with you as always.
Well, we were having some fun on Friday because when the timing didn't work out, it was because you were otherwise occupied, like talking to the President of the United States. okay, Mike, fine. We'll go ahead and let that one slide. Anyway, it's good to hear from you. Thanks for your time. I know how busy you are. So tell us about what's going on there, because you're very involved, obviously, as the head of the Republican Study Committee and the great framework you guys came up with recently, but also on the President's Task Force for Opening Up America Again. So what can you tell us about the progress of what's going on here?
Well, it's quite a bit, and yeah, I wanted to apologize to you on air. I was supposed to be with you Friday afternoon, but the one-hour session we had scheduled at the White House with the president actually went about 3 hours, so I missed a lot of things, but I hated that. Thanks for rescheduling.
Of course, absolutely.
Look, the reason we went long is because there is a lot of great substantive work going on, and we had in that meeting Friday at the White House was Secretary Mnuchin and Larry Kudlow, who's the chief economic advisor to the president, and Kevin Hassan was in there, several others, and some of the there was 19 of kind of what I would regard kind of be the thought leaders in Congress, and very fruitful discussion. The president is very I think he's leaning forward on this, and you know I've been very grateful for the way he's led. He's been completely transparent. I mean, to the point where some of his folks in the inner circle have said, "You don't need to talk so much, Mr. President." You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
he is.
Yeah.
He has defaulted towards giving, you know, too much information to the American people, and who could fault him for that? So I think there's no administration that it could have performed better under the circumstances. This, as he said many weeks ago, is a war. I mean, we're in a war against an unseen and unforeseen enemy, and we've done everything that any nation could do under the circumstances. There's a lot going on. Economic recovery is already beginning, and as the president phrased it to us on Thursday, he regards this to be a transition period, a transition back to greatness, as he said, and we're all going to be working all hands on deck to make that happen.
Yeah, because there's a challenging kind of narrative out there that you can't do both. You can't care for the vulnerable. You can't care for people that are being directly affected by the virus itself, as well as trying to care for the economy and all of the other, because there's, you know, deaths of despair are going to go up. There's so many different dominoes that are lining up behind just the virus effect itself. So what do you say to the people, Mike, that are kind of like, well, hey, if you start to open up, that means you don't care for people?
No, it's nonsense. That's a false choice, and I think people are using that for political purposes, and frankly, they're driving a wider chasm, a wedge between various groups of people in this country, and it's very sad. Here's the reality, Steve. We are the greatest nation in the history of the world, okay? We can protect lives and livelihoods at the same time. Those are not mutually exclusive pursuits. We're Americans, for goodness sakes. We can do this. And we have made the point very forcefully. And I think the reason the president asked me to serve on the Reopen America Task Force is because he knows that I would be, you know, very aggressive about this, but also reasonable. And the point is, you've got to allow the American spirit to flourish, right? We can trust Americans to act responsibly. We can trust people to, you know, engage in social distancing and use, you know, proper sanitation protocols. This is not rocket science. We can do it, but you have to allow the free market an opportunity to thrive. If you do, then small business owners and everyone else will innovate. They'll be creative. They'll look for a way to make it happen. But you cannot keep the economy shut down and prevent that possibility entirely. If you do, as you're alluding to there, you lead to even greater long-term negative health outcomes, right? I mean, Democrats have argued for generations that the greatest indicator of negative public health outcomes is poverty, right? Well, you keep the economy shut down, you're right, going to ensure that more people are pushed into that category, and it has just incalculable, unintended consequences. And that's why we've got to do this and do it right. I'll give you a quick example just to illustrate everything in a nutshell. You know, nail salons have been said that they'll be some of the last to open, right? I got a nail salon not far from my home here in North Louisiana, and they're very innovative. You know what they did? They went out and got one of those clear plastic sheets that you see now in the grocery store,
yep.
And they carved two holes in it, right? And Steve, you can put your hands or your feet through the holes, right? And they can work on you on the other side of the plexiglass.
Yeah.
There is no threat to anyone. It's safer than the grocery store, and yet they can't open up. Why? Let's let people use their common sense. I think that's really important virtue and something that we rely upon as Americans.
Yeah, and unfortunately, my wife and I have been talking, Gina and I have been talking about this a lot lately, and with the younger generation, millennials and now Gen Z, you know, 100 years ago, we're willing to step up. 80 years ago, we'll step up and fight Nazi Germany. We'll take on anything. And now we've got a whole generation or two that are kind of easily scared and easily cower in a corner. And so there is a cultural mandate there that we also need to pay attention to that, hey, before we used to come out and we'll fight it head on. And now we tend to cower. And I understand early on when we didn't know much, but as we've gotten more information, we should be more grounded in that reality. It's a real challenging and heartbreaking thing to see in America, as so many people are just kind of willing to, no offense to you, of course, just blindly follow these government mandates without questioning things.
Right.
One of the things, you mentioned small business, Mike, and this is one of the things, we're talking to Congressman Mike Johnson from Louisiana, who's on the President's Task Force for Reopening America. One of the things that was really disappointing to me last week and doing some research was, with all the money that's going to businesses, there's still the overwhelming majority of it's going to larger businesses, 100 employees more, as opposed to smaller businesses, less than 100 employees, which make up the lion's share of business in America. What can you tell us about that? Because I didn't expect the federal government to be able to do this very well just because of the size of it and turning on a dime, but that was really alarming to me.
Well, it was alarming, and it's probably something that we might have anticipated. I mean, obviously, the larger, more complex businesses and operations are going to have staff that are ready and dedicated. They'll have their paperwork in order. They'll be able to apply for something like this quicker. So when the second round of the CARES Act funding was passed by Congress, we put stipulations in there that a large portion of it had to be used for the smaller kind of mom and pop Main Street shops and businesses like that. And so that has been of some assistance. But I'll tell you, Steve, I just got off a conference call a few minutes before I jumped on the air with you of Republican leaders in the House. And we were lamenting together that there's a real problem right now, a misinterpretation that's out there, that somehow that the smaller businesses and the people who have gone and made availed themselves of this Paycheck Protection Program are somehow going to be responsible for paying it back now. And that's just simply not the case. If they're using it in good faith and they're using at least 75% of it for their payroll expenses, as was intended, they're going to be just fine. But there's somehow a misconception out there, and I think some people are using this for a political wedge, to scare people into either not applying for those loans if they're a small business, or some of them now even turning the money back in and not using it because they're afraid there are going to be repercussions for them. And I want to say on the air, and you can, you know, assure your listeners, that all those small business owners out there, don't worry, okay? The Treasury Department specifically said loans that were in excess of $2 million may do some sort of routine audit to make sure that those monies are not being misspent. But the smaller businesses, as long as you're operating in good faith, as long as you document this to the government, you're going to be just fine, and you should make use of that, because that was the intent of Congress. The whole idea behind this, Stephen, we talked about this, is that we wanted to make sure that employees would stay connected to their employers while we walk through this dark valley as a nation, as a people together. We need to be able to emerge on the other side of this, and we are now beginning to emerge out of that valley. But we have to have jobs to go back to. And if you sever the relationship between employees and employers, then you lose the ability for us to revive the economy. So that's the whole purpose, the rationale behind the Paycheck Protection Program. And thankfully, I think it's being used for that purpose.
And what's going on behind closed doors up there? We got about a minute and a half left. In terms of the Democrat response and the Democrat positioning, because, you know, my fear, and I think it's well-founded the whole time, has been, well, this is just another opportunity to use something to get rid of Trump. So what can you tell us about how they've been handling it?
Very sadly, very unfortunately, there are people who play politics, and they even do it at the time of a national crisis like a pandemic. And you're seeing that now. I think there are some who see a perverse incentive to make the chaos as great as possible, because they want to use that for their ultimate goal of removing Donald Trump in the election. And so we need to be wary of that. We need to call it out when we see it, and we need to force them to do the right thing for the American people.
Great point. Representative Mike Johnson, my good buddy from Louisiana. Thank you, brother. God bless you. Thanks for all your work.
You got it, man. Hang in there.
We'll talk again. You too. We'll be right back. 'Cause you are more than I could ever dream. This world could ever see. Forever. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. Good to be with you, as always, working through all these different issues. And make sure, I did this a little bit over the weekend. I just wanted to say it to you as hopefully my brother or sister in Christ. Let's not be afraid to kind of push back from the table a little bit. We're dining on all this stuff all the time. We're like gluttons on social media, gluttons on the news, gluttons on COVID this and COVID that and everything going on. And I think it's easy. It's easy for me anyway, as a Christian. Sometimes I sell my joy down the river because I allow myself to get consumed by everything going on. And Jesus already told us, in this world you will have trouble, but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. And we need to remember that. Whether we're talking about the Arbery case down in Georgia, whether we're talking about different states opening up, what's going on in the federal level, small businesses not getting the help that they need, favoritism most likely to big businesses, and the COVID-19 situation, and the financial situation as well. It's so easy to sell our joy down the river as if this is all there is, but we do not grieve. Talking about when we lose loved ones and friends and family, we don't grieve as those who have no hope. If you have Christ, you have ultimate hope. We need to remember that, too, when we look at the world and how broken it is, that we don't grieve over that as if we have no hope. Because one day, brother or sister in Christ, this will all be a distant memory at best. I don't even know that it'll show up on the radar screen. The new heavens and the new earth. Hey, you remember that COVID-19 thing? Really? When you're in the presence of the Lord and all this garbage is gone? Every tongue has already confessed. Every knee is bowed. Wipe away all the tears. Do you really think we'll remember this? I don't think we will. So let's just remember that, just trying to offer a little perspective. Also on the financial side, of course, we always talk to our good friend David Fisher from Landmark Capital, landmarkgold.com. David, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good today, my friend.
Yeah, that's a nice change of pace where we both have a little skip in our step. That's been rare as of late. So a lot going on there, but we're going to start where we should start. More often than not, all of us need to do that, is starting in the scriptures. We'll be in the New Testament today, Romans chapter 8. Of course, just probably the most powerful theological book in the Bible, Romans itself. But let's start there, and then we'll dive into some of these headlines.
Verse 25, but if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it. You know, this reminds me, you know, obviously most of us in our life have not had a experience that we have saw Jesus with our human flesh eyes. We have not seen him physically on the earth, so in front of us. Most of us have not had that experience. I'm sure there's some believers out there that are hearing our voice. There might be a handful of them that have that. But, you know, faith comes through hearing, but do we also have hope that if we focus with perseverance, because we've asked Jesus Christ in our life and he's become our Lord and Savior, then now we're in the realm of not just faith, but also hope. You know, it reminds me of a time when my kids were little. We first moved down to Phoenix and we had a pool, and they were sitting at the front door waiting for Dad to come home with their bathing suits on. They were eagerly awaiting. And, you know, I think that type of tenacity, that's what the Lord wants us to have in our faith towards him.
Yeah, it's such a great point, and that's where we got to remember that. But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it, and that's that thing that gives us that strange. And we're going to talk about dichotomy here in a second. That strange dichotomy where I grieve and I'm broken over the here and the now. I long for the there and the then. Part of me has this joy that's never touched, and part of me can be frustrated and angry and broken over the conditions of the world. But that's why we have to have that perseverance and wait eagerly for this hope that God has promised us, and most of us have experienced this in our lives as Christians. Man, it's such an important message, especially when things are just so crazy. So dichotomy, that's a great word. You put it in our overview for today. So the stock market seems to be doing well. If I look back at March 23rd, it was at 18,591. Today it's closing at 24,221. So, you know, a significant return there, not backed up to its highest levels, which is over 29,000. But we got that, which seems to be doing good. But the economy, you know, they came out the other day, 14.7% unemployment rate, 33 million people unemployed. Our national debt skyrocketing faster than we've ever seen it. So, How do we deal with that, dichotomy? That's the thing that probably frustrates me the most.
Well, this is kind of like the Dr. Doolittle movie, push me, pull you thing. They're working kind of not in conjunction, but against each other. And normally they're connected. And usually when you have a good economy, we have a good stock market. But this is all because of what happened. You said the date, March 23rd, what the Fed did. I mean, when the Fed says we have unlimited resources to help support the economy, that didn't change how much money went into the people's bank account. That didn't make any change in that. The government did that. And some of that's not near enough, and I'm not a socialist, but in reference to how much money really needs to happen towards to make the economy go the same direction the market is going, they haven't even really even touched reality of what needs to happen. So there is this Wall Street versus Main Street, unfortunately, happened. A lot of it has to do with the Fed. You know, think about, and some of it has to do with the market. You know, the S&P 500, 20% of that market, Steve, is represented in four stocks, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, and Google.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stocks still out there that are not performing at high levels, but they're still in the index. So there's now a dichotomy happening in the marketplace where good stocks are moving and some lesser stocks are not doing a thing. So, but this all comes down to a number. $3.7 trillion is how much of new treasuries is going to be created between April and September. Think about that, how much that is. That's going directly on the national debt. That'll put us at $28.8 trillion, call it $29 trillion, close enough. I said in December, I think it was, November maybe, that President Trump will have $28 to $30 trillion of national debt by the end of his term. I meant the second term, not the first one.
Yeah, man.
We're going to be there at the end of his first term. So debt is ballooning. The Fed is doing this. And this is also going to have ramifications. So we're not out of the woods. We haven't even dealt with the problem here as far as what they're doing to stop the problem of the markets going down and of the economy going down. That's not a fix yet. But when we deal with the fix of the fix, which I mean the debt, and we'll have to deal with it. You just can't print all this money and issue all these treasuries and not have to service that money. You have to service it. So that's going to be a bigger problem coming up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's one of the ones that we can't run away from. You can run, but you can't hide. What about the banks? Are banks going to be in trouble? Are we basically a bank collapse like we saw in 2008?
We have more money in banks now, much more than in 2008. But my question is then, why is Neil Kashkari, who's the president of the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis, saying recently that he's urging banks to sell around $200 billion in stock now to survive a coming crash or another possible bailout? So maybe banks don't have as much money in reference. They have more money in 2000 now than 2008, but in reference to where this thing could turn, they don't have enough money.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that the Fed said, that they don't need to have any money. Zero cash reserves is just insane. You know, I read a newsletter today that blew me away. It's a newsletter I get all the time. It's a stock newsletter and also one about the economy. And they actually are talking about the bail-in. This is a financial newsletter. The topic of it says the secret plan to introduce cash grabs, wealth taxes, and asset confiscation in U.S., and it goes and lists them. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just three things they say. Number one, freeze bank accounts and use them to bail in. Couldn't believe my eyes when I was reading this. Close the gate. Number two, on all investment funds, money markets, to stop you from getting your money out. And three, impose wealth taxes and seize assets. I couldn't believe what I was reading. It's a financial newsletter on what kind of stocks to buy, and this is where they're saying we could be in this environment. It sounds frightening, but it's now a real part of our future.
Well, the deeper the hole that we dig ourselves, the more tangible that threat becomes, because you get to the end of the line, you go, well, what are we going to do? And the only thing they can do at that point is to turn inward, which has happened. The bail-in has happened in other places. If you want to get some more information about that, you can go to David's website at landmarkgold.com. So speaking of that, what's gold doing in the midst of all this craziness?
Well, gold is outperforming stocks, even though there's been a recovery in some assets and stocks. There was a big institution in out of Britain, called Buchanan. They did a webinar, which was for stock investing once again. And the main theme that came out of this was this quote: "Gold needs to be the core asset for all investors." Once again, stock people are talking about gold. Two Bank of American well-regarded researchers were at the or attended the webinar. Michael Wiedmer, he says that gold is going to push around $3,000 an ounce in 18 months. Grievous Williams, though, said, and he's from Bank of America, said gold prices are going to push to $3,300 by the end of the year. That's almost double by between now and then. I don't think it's going to do that. I'm way more conservative than that. But I can say this. Central banks are buying more gold than they have ever bought before in 50 years. So there's going to be a big movement in gold. And it's really important to what's happening in this environment. It's to get some gold in your portfolio.
Real quickly, why do you think some people, like Dave Ramsey's always been kind of anti-gold, but I appreciate Dave Ramsey when it comes to debt stuff. I've never appreciated when it comes to investment stuff. But why do you think there's still some people like that are like, no, don't do that?
Gold doesn't pay a dividend like stock, but it doesn't need to. It's outperformed the stock market every time we've had a recession by far.
Yeah, pretty good point there. How can people get more information, David?
They can call us the old-fashioned way, 844-879-8882, or go to landmarkgold.com.
All right, buddy, thanks so much. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again real soon. God bless you.
God bless you.
All right, pal, talk again real soon. I'll be back tomorrow. A lot going on tomorrow. A lot more happening in the news. Obviously, we're paying attention to that, trying to bring a Christian worldview to bear against all of it. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always used to say, ever forward.